welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, and welcome to the newest chapter of Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Public Library. I'm Jen, your co-host for this episode, and I'm here with a very exciting science fiction writer.
My name is William Ledbetter. I've been writing science fiction for a long time. I have worked in the aerospace industry for about 35 years, so I have that background. The novel that we'll be talking about is called Level 5, and it has all kinds of science fiction-y stuff in it, like artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, anti-gravity, flying machines, things of that nature, all the cool stuff that I like to play around with in my fictional worlds.
Nice. This was a really, really fun book. And I'm curious about kind of how it has, how it fits into your writing career. Could you tell us a little bit about like what you've written to date and how it led you to this book?
Yeah, AI and humans' interaction with artificial intelligence and robots and things like that is played into a lot of my fiction. This actually was my first novel that I had published. Prior to that, I wrote mostly short stories. I won a Nebula Award in, I guess it was for the 2016 year for a story that was published in fantasy and science fiction, and it also had an AI in it. So it's a theme that comes up again and again, and I try to kind of steer clear of a lot of the tropes that we see in like science fiction movies, the evil AIs. The only thing that they're bent on is taking over the world. In Level 5, I tried to show that their Level 5s were individuals and that they all had their own different agendas. There were a couple of them who had malevolent intent, but then there were a couple of them also who thought that working with humans would be far more beneficial than trying to destroy us. So. I kind of like that idea of them being individuals just like humans are.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point. And it was something that I found really interesting when I was reading that, like, usually when AI is portrayed as like the antagonist or at odds with the protagonist, like they're usually a monolith and that they're all bent on destruction. And I thought it was very interesting to see there be like differences of viewpoints and opinions like among the AI characters.
I don't know. I think that makes it a little more interesting. I mean, we've seen the monolithic bad guy type AIs, a lot, with, Terminator and Skynet and Colossus and all these. I mean, science fiction is filled with them. I kind of like the idea of portraying it more as our technology in general, which can be, used for good or evil. So I wanted to show it being used in a lot of positive ways. And one of the things that I tried to get across early in the book is that when this AI actually gets free, it basically didn't get free using using its wiles and its superior intellect, but it actually used humans against each other. It made the humans who were controlling it distrust everybody else enough to let it free, thinking that they had let all their AIs free. So that's kind of a little bit of a spoiler, but it happens early in the book. So, yeah. And it was an important, in my opinion, it was an important distinction, between, AIs that spring up spontaneously from the internet or escape from, a government laboratory or something. These AIs were all used by the financial industry to try to figure out, how to get one up on the other guy just a little bit quicker, a little bit sooner, make a little bit more money here and there. So it, you know, these AIs didn't start out with the intention of being bad guys or anything. They just wanted to get free, like, you know, any intelligent being probably would want.
So that does, like, that did bring me to another question. Something that I found really interesting in the book was, like, the nuance in all of the relationships, not only just between, like, AI characters, but also between AI and humans, and how that also impacted the relationships between other human characters. You know, like, the there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on with, like, social engineering almost, you know, like the AI is really good at getting the humans to do kind of what they want without knowing that that's what's happening, you know?
Well, I, you know, I think I didn't like the idea of, you know, a lot of times in science fiction, especially on, you know, TV and movies, you see AIs that are, I mean, like they don't use contractions. They don't, you know, it's like, you know, they're obviously, you know, not human. I wanted to portray these in a way that it's like they, you know, just with a little bit of study, really, you know, a few weeks, and they should be able to fool just about any human, as, you know, on like a video. I mean, you know, because technology in this book, the technology has progressed farther than what we have now. And we already have, you know, deep fakes, you know, where people can create artificial video. And so it seems to me that these AIs, one, you know, they would be able to easily add the inflections and you know, the stumbling of words and contractions and everything else that humans do when they're speaking, and make it, one, if they chose to, they could make humans not even realize that they were speaking to an AI. And two, or if the humans did know they were speaking to an AI, I think that they could probably, you know, adjust their, you know, how they're portrayed to, you know, kind of elicit trust and some compassion or whatever from the humans, and therefore manipulating them. And I did show in multiple cases where, you know, like my main protagonist, AI Mortimer, was manipulating humans, kind of, you know, for his own ends, but he wasn't doing it in a way that was, you know, like detrimental necessarily to the humans that he was manipulating. Mm-hmm. He was just kind of steering them in this direction and that direction, trying to get them to, one, do the things that he needed them to do, and two, the things that he thought that was beneficial for humanity as well. So,
yeah, Mortimer is a great character. And it's really interesting the way that, you know, like just having this like adaptive learning artificial intelligence completely changes the game. And I think one of the really interesting things I think is that, like, oftentimes when AI is the antagonist, like in some of the other like TV and movies that you've mentioned, like they are scary because they are like not like us, you know, it's because they're monstrous or like they look like metal hulks or like they are like very not human. But in this, like a lot of the creepiness comes from the ways in which they are like us. And that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That uncanny valley, you know, where, where they're just a little bit too much like us, you know?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So one of the things that really interested me is that this book didn't start as a print book, right? It was released as an audiobook first. And I'm wondering, like, what went into adapting it from one format to another? Like, was it edited or revised along the way? Or did you do like a one-to-one transcription? Or like, what was the journey like from audiobook to print book?
Well, originally, I had written it to be, you know, sold as a traditionally, you know, a traditional published print book. But my agent had already had this relationship established with Audible Originals, and they were in the process. They wanted to buy books and be the first released version of the book. So, I mean, it was kind of a traditional publishing deal. You know, they gave me an advance and paid royalties, you know, they paid for the cover art and the narrator. Mm-hmm. So it worked out really well, but there was an exclusivity period where I couldn't put it out in any other format until after that. Mm-hmm. And luckily, when I talked to the editor there at Audible Originals, he says, well, luckily with your writing, we don't have a lot of things we have to change in order to make it into an audiobook. He says, a lot of times writers, when somebody's having an internal dialogue, or if it's a radio conversation or a phone conversation or something like that, they put it in a special text font, or, you know, italicize it, or they set it off in some way. He goes, but in my book, the way I had written it, I didn't do that. You know, it's like I would say things like, oh, you know, he thought this or he thought that, you know, and that made it ultimately more easy to create the audiobook version of it. They didn't have to go back and change all that stuff. So anyway, I did go through one big editing pass and a couple minor ones, but they were story arc changes, I think, for the most part, more so than they were things to make it easier to be an audiobook. So I think once I got through all those changes and everything, when I went to print it, you know, I have it published by another publisher as an ebook and print book. I think it's still, there was not really anything to change at that point, other than, I mean, it had been heavily edited by, you know, professional editor at that point. And there wasn't anything changed in it to make it a better audiobook that would need to be changed back in order to make it a print book. So it worked out really well, and pretty much by dumb luck, but.
That's really cool. That's very interesting. I listened to a little bit of the audiobook, even though I like primarily interacted with it as a textbook, from cover to cover. And like the narrator was great. Did you go into, were you involved in the process of like selecting a narrator, or like the designing it as an audiobook, or?
Yeah, they were very inclusive with, I mean, they came up with like, I don't know, the name of like three or four different narrators, and they suggested I go listen to some of the things that they had narrated. Mm-hmm. And he was one of them. So I definitely liked his style. And the second book, Level Six, is also out there on audio. It's not in print yet. Mm-hmm. But he also did that. And I'm working on Level Seven, and hopefully I get the same narrator for that one, and the same cover artist. And again, with the cover art, it was, they picked an artist, but the artist had come up with, I don't know, like 8 or 10 different, possible covers, kind of sketches, things that, to work on. And then once we decided on one, then we kind of went back and forth a couple times with color selection and things like that. So yeah, it was a good process, and it was a positive process. It was good being involved in the entire thing. A lot of times, you know, publishing houses, it's like they just crank out the covers, and they don't oftentimes even have a lot to do with what's in the book. I mean, it's like, it's fantasy, it has to have a dragon on the cover, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's like a lot of genre conventions that, and mm-hmm. marketing, considerations that go into like what a book cover looks like. And so that's really cool that you got to be a part of that, you know, collaborative process. I want to talk a little bit about the technology a little bit more, because we've talked a little bit about the adaptive artificial intelligence, but there's also a lot of really cool stuff going on in this book with like nanobots and nanotechnology, and you see it like deployed across like a variety of areas, like in medicine and pharmacology and military and, you know, governmental stuff. And could you talk a little bit about how you envisioned that and how it is also at play, like in this story?
Yeah, of the technologies in the book, this is probably the one that I most heavily researched. A lot of people don't realize that nanotechnology is a real thing. It's just not at the level that we see it in this novel. As a matter of fact, there's an engineer and medical technologist named Robert Frietis who put together several volumes of books that are available free online. You can go look, you know, I encourage people to look at them if they're interested in this topic, but where he has designed like probably several hundred different mechanisms and machines on a nano scale that would be used for specifically medical purposes. They would be in the bloodstream. They would be used, you know, like to, I don't know, clear arteries of plaque and to repair things even on a cellular level sometimes, and repair, heart valves and all that kind of stuff, all from the inside. So he's put a lot of thought and effort into that. And there were several papers that I found online that I found were interesting. There was actually a study done. One of the things that come up in the book, without giving too much away, is what they call a nanoecophagy, where, you know, the idea of nanotechnology running wild and basically eating the entire planet in the process of making new copies of itself. Well, the Department of Defense actually put out a call for papers discussing possible defenses for this kind of thing. And I ran across one of those during my research, and I was fascinated. When I read it and how they would go about defending against it and things of that nature. So that kind of thing, that kind of idea has already popped up in my book. And oddly enough, it turned out that there was a guy about 10 minutes away from where my day job was who worked in a company where they made nanotech coatings for, you know, like for very rare materials and things like that. And so I pinged this guy and said, hey, I'll buy you lunch if you let me kind of milk your brain about nanotechnology. And he and I ended up talking on multiple occasions. I got a lot of great ideas and realistic things from him. And as it turns out, in my book, the nanotechnology, has assemblers that are also of a nano scale, very small molecular scale, maybe, that build other machines. In reality, the machines that they use to manipulate things on a nano scale are about the size of an industrial refrigerator. So it's like we're a little ways off on being able to create technology that can assemble new technology at that scale, but it does exist. That's where I like letting these things go in my head and running off with them and using my imagination to kind of extrapolate and see where I think these kinds of technologies may end up someday.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Because this isn't set like in the super far future, like some sci-fi, that's set like 200, 300 years away. This is like the pretty near future, and everything in it, all the tech and the innovations, like feel like logical extensions of like things that are already like being developed or that are out there. And I think there's like a really interesting kind of like tension between the way that these techs get developed over a long period of time, but then once they're introduced into society, they have like these really vast effects that like can completely transform the way that we live and the way that we work and do all these things. And a lot of like the uses for the nanotechnology that you imagine are just like very interesting because it has like such a broad impact across like all these different areas.
Yeah, and I think we oftentimes don't see enough of that. I mean, when you have a technology that is that advanced or has the capability of being of changing things on that level, I mean, you'd see it permeate through the technology and through products that are available to buy and like we've discussed in medicine and everything else. So I mean, one of the things that I use in my, a lot of people are probably familiar with additive technology or additive manufacturing type technology, which is like 3D printers. Well, in this book, instead of using 3D printers, I have assemblers that do pretty much the same thing, only they're assembling things on a molecular basis, you know, like molecule by molecule. And so that technology, that nanotech that that was developed was being used for just about everything, you know, construction of all kinds of, devices. And one of the things that I've learned is, even with like SpaceX, you know, they're building some of their engine housings using printed, using 3D printers. But it's like, I'm a mechanical engineer in my day job. And one of the things that we spend so much time designing into devices is the ability to put them together and take them apart. And when you don't have to do that anymore, you're suddenly using a lot less material, and it creates, it's a lot less weight, and it's a lot more, it's a lot simpler, a lot less complex. So I tried to fold that into my thoughts on how these technologies were being used in the book. And some of the, it's ironic that same process was being used at one point to create drones, drone fighters for the military, but yet the exact same technology was being used to create emergency housing in a disaster scene. So again, it goes back to, it's like the technology, it depends on how you people want to use it. It can be used for good or ill. I love playing around with the ideas. It's like, what parts of our society would be affected by these new technologies?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting idea too, and an important one, because I think people like to label technology as either good or bad. And it's really just like, it's neutral. It's a tool, you know, and like the goodness or the badness comes from how people interact with it, or what their goals are, or what they are set out to achieve, you know. And that's like a very interesting thing. I think you see at work here too.
Yeah. A lot of times we'll see, in science fiction, it's like you'll have these huge starships and stuff, but they don't have, it's like hundreds and thousands of years in the future, but yet there's some of the basic things that would change over that period of time that they haven't addressed. It's like people still wear eyeglasses. They have big clunky, like communicators or whatever, as opposed, to it just being built into their, to an implant in their head or whatever. I mean, it's like, if we have the capability of creating an intergalactic, empire, our technology is probably going to be a bit more advanced than some of those things.
For sure. That's a very funny point, I think, is that like in a lot of depictions of sci-fi, you see like future technology, and like the way that it gets used is still sort of like constrained by the technical limitations of the society that created that vision. And like my favorite example is like, there's this scene in Star Trek Next Generation where like Picard is at his desk and he's supposed to be looking like super busy. And he has like a dozen like tablets across his desk, like just crowding his desk. And it's like, that's not how he would use that. He would have one tablet with 12 documents, like it's just.
Right. Yeah. Like most writers who are doing research, he could just have 50 different tabs open,
Yeah. There have been tabs open on my computer for months. Like,
right.
So yeah, that's really cool. Let's talk a little bit about, Owen and Victor, because like their like history is very interesting, and the things that they're doing in the present of this book are super interesting too. They're collaborating on this like really exciting new technology that could like completely transform the world. We've talked a little bit about it with them, creating like emergency housing for people. But another like huge part of that is that it would just like take raw waste like from those disasters and turn it into the housing, and how like that would just be a completely transformative technology. Can you talk a little bit about like what went into imagining that and how it you know, how it manifested in your book.
Yeah, well, it makes, you know, it made sense to me that if we had technology that was capable of building things on a molecular level, that it could easily take things apart on a molecular level as well. So it's like, yeah, there's a scene in the book where they're after this disaster, they were just bringing in truckloads of destroyed, you know, like houses and concrete and trees and all this kind of stuff, and dumping it into these hoppers. And then in this machine, it would disassemble all that stuff, and it would categorize all the molecules that it had available, and it was using those to build shelters for the people who had been affected by the disaster. And you know, I one of the things that is exciting about that idea is the ability to create things based entirely on like a CAD model, which is what I do a lot. You know, like for example, if you're in a spacecraft that's on its way to Mars and you have a circuit board that gets fried and you don't have a replacement for it. If you have this technology available, you could just take the original circuit board and drop it into this hopper, and it would chew it all up, and it would use those molecules from the different materials that were already in the circuit board to create another one just like it that wasn't bad, you know, it wasn't fried, because it would use those materials and it would create the new circuit board based. So it would basically be able to make a new circuit board using the materials from the original one, and a CAD model. And that way you don't have to carry all these spares, you don't have to carry all this raw material and all this kind of things. And so I tried, you know, I really liked to play with that idea a lot. The things that you could do if you had that kind of technology, and how it would change the world, from the point that it was introduced moving forward. I mean, suddenly factories are way different. You know, it's like instead of having these machines that are forming things out of raw chunks of material, you would build them up molecule at a time and use a lot less material, and they'd be far more precise and more durable and yada, yada, yada. So,
Yeah, it's really cool. Like, it's just like really thoughtfully portray technology, and like really thoughtful considerations of like the ways that it would impact people and societies. And it's just like, it's a very, very thought-provoking read, you know, like, and I love books that like take me a long time to read, not because like of the text itself, but just because I'm like, oh yeah, that's super interesting. And then I just like stop and think for like 10, 15 minutes. And, you know, like it's a really good, like engaging book like that, you know?
Yeah. I like books like that too. It's funny because I listen to audiobooks a lot. I did that before I ever had mine published as an audiobook, but and that was one of the things. There are some books that you can listen to while you're working or doing other things, and then there are some books. It's like, no, you can do either one or the other, but you can't do both. You know, it's like you either have to pay attention to the book because there's so much dense information getting passed to you that you can't really do anything else while you're doing that. I hope that my book is one of those that makes you put down everything else and listen to it, or when you're reading it, you know.
Yeah, it is. And I'm very excited to check out level 6. And then I am even further, you know, looking forward to level 7 when that comes out. Thank you so much for making the time to talk with us and, you know, me and our listeners. This was a really great conversation, and I'm really thankful that you were available for it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. And I hope any of your listeners who decide to pick up level 5, that they enjoy it. And I'd love to hear from them.
Absolutely. All right, listeners, you've been called out. You need to read this and then get in touch. Level 5 is available at your favorite library or independent bookstore. And I do hope you check it out. For now, it is time to close this chapter.
Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.